right. It is that time. So we got this country called Vietnam. It had a long history that was complicated. But there also was an effort to strengthen itself. And context is crucial. As some of you know, hopefully, in the 16th century, the 1500s, the Portuguese made their way around Africa, got into Asia. And when they arrived in Asia, going to Italy, Matthew. Did you add the class, or have you been in the class the whole time?
I've been in the class.
Where have you been? Muno. If I could, I would like to see both you and DeMarcus after class, just so I could bring you up to speed. All right, anyways, context. So Portuguese get there, and they were trying to get around the Muslim Empire so they could get the good stuff. The silks, the spices, and all the rest. Yada, yada, yada stuff. But when they arrived, they discovered that there was a very complex, highly organized Asian trade network going on. And it had been going on for hundreds of years. And all of the countries and peoples from Africa all the way up to Korea had been engaging in commerce and exchanges. They also discovered advanced civilizations, the Hindus, the Chinese, and so forth. When the Portuguese got here, what they wanted to do is they wanted to be able to tap the Asian network so that way they could start getting stuff, precious items, the rare items that people in Europe would pay megabucks for. From that point going forward, first the Portuguese, then the Dutch, then the English, then the French, the Americans, and other people started making their way into Asia. They would attempt to subjugate entire portions of the region by basically taking control of the economies. Now, you should all know what the Spanish did when they came to Central America and when they went to South America. They toppled the Aztecs and conquered them. They toppled the Inca, conquered them. But the Europeans couldn't do that in Asia. There was just too many people. The civilizations were too strong. But if they could take control of the economy, they could control the country. Well, the British, the Dutch, what they did was they would take over huge regions. I mean, this is how the British took over India, how the Dutch took over Indonesia. They would make an alliance with one chieftain and help that chief basically fight its wars in exchange for more rights, more privileges, more money. Slowly building up a native army loyal to the Dutch or the English, and then basically going province by province. Well, by 1800, at the same time, when Zhao Pan basically overthrew the system and took control and started making the empire, the British took over India. The Dutch took over Indonesia. And everyone was next looking to get into China. The Vietnamese had contact with the Chinese. They knew what they were doing. The Europeans to other people. And that's one of the reasons why the Nguyen dynasty was trying to keep them out. Because they wanted to keep their autonomy. They wanted to keep their independence. But after the British instigated the Opium Wars, and basically impose their will over the Chinese, soon all of the Europeans were looking to do the same, every single corner of open real estate that was available. And the French set their sights on Vietnam. And that would be significant. What was the motivation? What was the trigger that the French would use to justify their initial incursion?
The mistreatment of Catholics.
There you go. Religion. The Vietnamese basically banned Catholicism and were arresting Catholic missionaries, and in some instances, killing them. Well, as it turns out, 1558, just after the Second Opium War came to an end, at a point when the French had a military force already in Asia, the Vietnamese would execute two Spanish priests. Well, when that occurred, Napoleon III was just like, yes! And he, along with his good friends and neighbors to the south, the Spanish, would declare war on the Vietnamese. They would launch an invasion, 14 warships, 3,000 troops, and from that point onward, for the next 25 years, bit by bit, the French would slowly come and conquer all of Vietnam. And they would not do so peacefully. They were not afraid to engage in tactics that we would call violent. They would not be afraid to trigger what we would call atrocities. Because the French were motivated by money. And to make matters worse, because the regime had kept isolated, kept the foreign merchants out, the level of military technology they had was 18th century technology. So yes, they had guns, they had cannon, but they had the guns and the cannon like were used during the Napoleonic Wars. Military technology had increased by leaps and bounds in the half century. No longer were Europeans using matchlock muskets. A musket, smooth bore firearm. Matchlock, the trigger was ignited by opening up a little pan, putting a little gunpowder in the pan, and basically using a slow burning wick. So when you would pull the trigger, if the match did not have enough spark in it, it would come down and it would hit the pan. And you'd have to wait a second or two before it basically went off. Yes, it still had a lot of lethality, but because you could not predict when it was going to go off, it wasn't really accurate. Because if you know anything about firearms, you know, if you change where your angle is, even a fraction of an inch, you're basically going to miss your target. Plus, the guns were old. They weren't well maintained. So there was a good percentage of them that when the Vietnamese would go to shoot, they'd just blow up in their arms. What were the Europeans using? Well, at this point, they started using rifles. Instead of a smooth bore barrel, there was a groove, a wrapping groove that was carved into the barrel. instead of shooting a round ball that kind of bounced down the barrel, they used what were called mini balls, which were essentially shaped similar to what technically today we call a bullet. So instead of it bouncing down the barrel like a ball, what it did was it would revolve and it would come out like a spiraling football. It could go straighter, longer, faster, which means it was more lethal. And instead of the matchlock, they were using percussion caps. Percussion cap is like a little... No, I don't think they had that. I think they banned it because it was bad. It's a toy. But back when I was a kid, we used to have cap guns. If I say cap gun, you know what I'm talking about? So they had two different types, some with the little strips with the cap that you could put in, or some with like the little round thing, so you got like a revolver and go bang, bang, bang. Well, a single one of those is what basically a percussion cap is. So it's like this little brass cap that you put a little gunpowder in there to cause the spark, and you would mount it on a firing pin. So when you pulled the trigger, it would come down and slam into the gunpowder. You knew exactly when it was going to go off once you were highly trained. Better guns, more accurate, more consistency. Plus, they're no longer using cast iron cannon anymore. By this point, they're using, technically smaller cannon, but they're brass. So when they got heated, they were less likely to crack. So when the French, they only had a few thousand men, and they're going against tens of thousands of Vietnamese, the Vietnamese might as well have been coming at them with swords and spears. Didn't stand a chance. So even though he unleashed his soldiers, he can't stop them. So what does he decide to do? No more fighting, I'll just give you land. And what he tries doing is he tries giving to the French the part of his empire that was the farthest away from his capital. The lands in southern Vietnam, which at the time were known as Cochinchina, or Cochin China, as we would say it in English. Well, once you give them the taste, they're going to want more. In addition to getting the land, the French wanted Thu Duoc to sign a treaty. Because that's what the Europeans did. But this treaty was similar to the treaties that the British used on the Indians, or the British and the French were using on the Chinese. This is an unequal treaty. You know, this was not an equal contract. This is not quid pro quo, I give you, you give me. No. This is one side wins and the other side loses. But it's in paper, so it's binding. The Vietnamese would lose these three provinces. Essentially, they weren't even lands that the French would occupy. They were cut out of the empire. They were now the property of France. They also got a very important island, that little dip out there. That island would be the main naval base of the French for the next 80 years. So they could basically build up a military force and it not even be in Vietnam. Vietnam would also be forced to stop killing Catholics. So the missionaries have to come back. So, southern Vietnam, the island,
Catholicism.
And here's the best part. They would also have to pay. They'd have to cover the war expenses. And these war reparations were, they had to be paid in Mexican pesos. 4 million Mexican pesos. Why Mexican pesos? Well, interestingly enough, Vietnam for a while used pesos as their currency. All right. Well, the problem that Tua Doc had was he couldn't pay the reparations. He didn't have the money to pay what the French demanded. Sure, give him the land, that's fine. Fine, we'll stop killing Catholics, fine. We just can't pay the bill. So Tua Doc would attempt to renegotiate the contract. Plus, truth be told, his people were very outraged by this. But Napoleon's like, no, we're not going back to the bargaining table. It is what it is. Now, by the way, the very same year, France kind of started doing the same thing to Cambodia. And Cambodia would surrender itself to the French. So technically, the king of Cambodia was still the king, but it would technically become a protectorate. So the French were kind of like in charge, which now meant they had control over the southern tip of the Indo-Chinese Peninsula. And once they solidified their control, they started demanding more. They demanded that Tua Doc hand over the three remaining southwestern provinces. Not that you need to remember the names, but Vinh Mong, Hao Tien, and Chau Doc. And I didn't put the map on there. So let's go back here. See if I can find them on the little map that I did. Oh. All right. So this is what they got. This would be the new addition. Located right smack dab in the middle is the major port in southern Vietnam, Saigon. The French said, well, we own the rest of the tip, just give us it all. Well, Tua Doc decides this time, I'm not going to say anything. Because if I say anything, they're going to somehow railroad me into agreeing to these terms. So silence will be my response. Which is kind of funny. Because when no official response was given, the French simply sat back and said, okay, then he agrees. So what did they do? They took it. They sent in their troops. They ordered all of the Vietnamese officials to leave. And they basically took over operations. And then they would declare the southern tip to be a colony, which they called French Indochina. Remember when we talked last class? Vietnam used to be made up of three zones. The northern part, the central part, and the southern part. Well, now France has control over the south. Next, they'd look to the north. Not only would they take advantage of the Mekong Delta region down in the south in around Saigon, but they also wanted to take advantage of the Red River Delta region up in Tonkin, the north. And the French had a virtual open door because, as it turns out, the Vietnamese government didn't actually control the north. The north was in a state of chaos, which was opportunity. And by the way, unlike the south, there was good stuff in the north. Iron, copper, tin. Rich veins were in the north. Plus, they had some coal deposits, and of course, they had lots of forests there. So, Europeans had wanted to kind of get a taste of this region for decades, but now France had an opportunity. Why? Well, simple. The north was controlled by criminals. They were pirates, they were bandits, they were rebels. All causing a mucky muck up in North Vietnam. Some of the groups actually formed armies. Powerful armies. And they became known as flag armies. And unfortunately for Tu Doc, his government did not have the means to deal with the pirates or these armies. So it's kind of like you have a parent that has a kid that's a brat. And the parent doesn't control the kid because the parent can't control the kid. So instead of disciplining the child, the parent just lets the kid continue to grow up to be a brat. Well, as a result, even if Tu Doc said to the North to do what I wanted, they weren't going to listen. So the French are like, you know something, we want that stuff, we'll deal with the pirates. So, in the early 1870s, they began trying to penetrate the Red River Delta and began trying to push up north to get access to those minerals and resources. Some of the pirates made deals with the French, but some of the pirates tried to resist. And what did the French do? Well, as these wonderful colored images show, they would simply land and they'd shoot them. Now, this was not clean. Both sides saw a tremendous amount of casualties. But in the end, even the pirates couldn't resist the French firepower. So once the North was subdued, the French contacted Huey, the emperor, in the capital city, and basically said, hey, look, we beat the North. We're going to take it from you. We'll take care of it for you. So in 1874, they forced the emperor to sign a treaty that became known as the Treaty of Saigon. And it's in this treaty that France basically said, yeah, we're going to protect the North. We're going to protect Tonkin. Now, technically, Tu Doc was still the emperor. But of what? He no longer controls the North. He no longer controls the South. All he has is Annam, which is the middle part of the country, which has very low population, very few resources. So for all sakes and purposes, the French are now in charge. But even the imperial throne would be toppled. Because in 1882, Tu Doc would essentially try to fight back. He would make a deal with the Chinese for the Chinese to send some troops to help him drive out the French.
He also would make a deal with the largest pirate army in the north, the Black Flags. They would form this hodgepodge alliance. But just like they did in the south, just like they did in the north, the French went right at Huế, the capital itself. They would land a detachment of 5,000 Marines. They would destroy the forts that guarded the access to the river, sail their ships upstream, and they would threaten to open fire on the capital. Well, faced with this, the emperor submitted. And in doing so, the throne would essentially sign away Anand in the Treaty of Huế, 1883. This was a 27-article treaty, sometimes called the Harmon Accord. Essentially, what it was a complete subjugation of Vietnam. Not that I'm going to make you remember the specifics of it, but let's just say the emperor in the capital would essentially become a puppet of the French. He was allowed to rule so long as he did France's bidding. But the French had access to the rest of the country. They could access the waterways, they could access the markets, they could extract whatever resources they wanted to. Essentially, they made it a colony. Now here's the weird thing. The local Vietnamese did not accept this treaty. So one of the weird things was, as many of the organized armies, like the pirate armies, they didn't surrender their weapons. They simply kept their weapons and hid them. So right out of the gates, there was a capacity to resist. And the other irony is when this treaty was brought back to Paris, the government in Paris, they didn't accept the treaty. They didn't ratify it. Because the French government sat back and said, why do we want to make this a colony? If it's a colony, that means they're in charge. They have to send their people. They have to govern it. They have to police it. And that takes money. That takes resources. That takes men. Most of the delegates in the French Parliament couldn't find Vietnam on a map. What are we going to do? Ask the taxpayers of France to pay for this? Instead, they wanted it to be a protectorate. And the difference? You allow the local government to rule in the name of. But, for all sakes and purposes, by this treaty, 1882, Vietnam was no longer an independent country. It would lose its sovereignty. Now, interestingly enough, Thu Doc was dead by the time the treaty was formalized. He died heirless. So he would be succeeded by his younger brother, Hiep Hoa. Well, when the ministers saw what the emperor signed, they actually forced the emperor to commit suicide. And then they picked a kid who would serve as a puppet, Kien Phoc. He was 15 years old. He happened to be the nephew of Tua Doc. That's what he was. But his reign was short. Because when the kid, I don't know, maybe had a growth spurt or got a little testosterone going through puberty, apparently he started talking in the palace like he was going to organize a resistance movement and he was going to liberate Vietnam for the French. From the French. The kid was poisoned shortly thereafter. Well, knowing that the regents, the high-ranking officials in the palace, were terrified of the French would completely take advantage of this situation. And with no negotiation, the French officials simply showed up at the palace, put down a piece of paper, and forced them to sign it. They didn't even get to read it first. And what the Treaty of Huey of 1884 did was change the language of the treaty of the year before. This said France would be a colony. This said France would be a protectorate. And what's the difference? Well, there would be a Vietnamese government. But the Vietnamese government would be basically the agents of France. Questions? Well, if you're able to tell the national government what to do, you're basically in charge. But the French weren't done. French were not done. Nope. Just as they were basically slowly rolling over Vietnam, they were doing the same throughout much of the rest of the Indo-Chinese Peninsula. They, as I've already said, had rolled over Cambodia, but they were also in the process of doing the same thing to Laos. And by 1887, they would establish what became known as the Indo-Chinese Union. This would be a union of separate political entities. Vietnam would be sliced up into three regions: Annam, Tonkin, and then Cochin China. And Cambodia would be there as well. Each one would have a local regional government of local officials appointed by the French to rule in the France's name. Oh, I've already said this, and they would add Laos and Cambodia as well. Each would be a separate protectorate. Except for Cochin China. In 1887, the French basically couldn't stand the local government, so got rid of them and sent French officials in to take control directly. The original capital would be Saigon, but eventually it would be moved to Hanoi. So up here would be the base of operations for the entire Union. Questions? Now's where we start getting technical. Even though the protectorates and the colony had their own local governors, the whole union would be governed by a governor general. Beginning in 1887, there would be a series of provisional and acting French diplomats that came over and did it for a couple of weeks, a couple of months. But in 1897, France would send their first official governor general, Paul Dumay, who would be governor general for 6 years. Now, who was Paul Dumay? A name you never heard of, and I wouldn't expect you to hear of him. But he was a lifelong politician in France. He served in their version of Congress, their parliament. He had also served as the Minister of Finance 3 times. Heck, at one point, he would be elected as president of France. So he was a well-known politician, well-capable, well-respected. Ironically, he would end up getting assassinated in 1932 by a Russian. But in terms of his service over the Indo-Chinese Union, he is credited with basically creating the administrative system, the government, that France would use to control Indochina all the way up until it lost control in the 1950s. He would centralize authority at the top. There would be local governments in the towns, in the cities, in the villages. They were just figureheads. They were not allowed to make laws. They were not allowed to make regulations. They only could enforce the rules that he established, top-down control. There would even be emperors still, technically, but the emperors were just figureheads. And they served only so long as he liked them. But during his 7 years of being governor general, I think there was like 6 emperors. He just basically said, no, you gotta go. He's rude. Gotta go. Gotta go. But he also made the important decision to appoint French officials in all of the high-ranking government offices. So he basically let it be known that France is in charge. And what did they do? This is what they did right here. France would focus on economic exploitation. They would go in and they would attempt to transform the economy and the societies to serve the will of the French. Interestingly enough, the status under French law designated the Indo-Chinese Union as a colonie d'exploitation. The French viewed it as a colony to be exploited, literally. Exploited how? Well, any way they wanted to. The government for this union was paid for by taxes collected locally, and the government would have full economic control. For example, they would establish government monopolies over opium, salt, rice, alcohol. So if you wanted to, say, sell salt, you couldn't, because the government sold the salt. If you wanted to sell rice, you could grow rice, but you couldn't sell it. You had to give it over to the government, and then the government sold it. You do it in the form of taxes. Alcohol. You wanted to have a drink of something, you bought it from the government. And what did the government do with those? Well, interestingly enough, the government also established consumption quotas. The government told all the people of Vietnam how much salt they had to buy, how much rice they had to buy, how much alcohol they had to buy, how much opium they had to buy. And the government profited off of that. Just from those four products, the colonial government was able to generate 44% of its revenue just by making people buy the products that the government wanted them to. The government also created infrastructure by building massive public works programs. They built railroads. They built highways. They built harbors. They built bridges, canals, communication networks, running water, sewerage, you name it. Ironically, every single major constructed project in Vietnam, all the way up until the Americans arrived, were all signed off or started or created when Dumour was there. And in fact, this bridge is the Paul Dumour Bridge, which is still in Hanoi today. Why did Dumour want this? Well, if you're going to suck a country dry, you got to be able to move the product. So many laws were used, designated what had to be produced, who could produce it, and of course, who it could be sold to, that it's clear that the exploitation was like taking an orange and squeezing it dry. They're trying to get every last drop of juice out of Vietnam. Oh, and by the way, they were also telling the Vietnamese what to buy. They had to buy French products or French condone products. They also didn't allow the Vietnamese to make many things. In fact, most industries were outlawed, except for industries related to locally, or products that were consumed locally. So, for instance, there were sugar refineries, there were breweries, there were distilleries, there were paper mills, glass factories, cement factories. But all of those products were used domestically. You didn't produce so much that you could export them. No. Just enough to get by. Ironically, one of the greatest industrial establishments was a textile factory that was built in the city of Nam Dinh. Huge factory, equal to the old brick factories that you can see in a lot of the towns that are in the area, in the cities. Well, at its height, it employed 5,000 people. Because the French made it a law that all people in Vietnam had to wear clothes that were produced locally. But because the industry was so limited, it's estimated that even at its height in 1930, no more than 100,000 people would work in what we would call factories or industries. So factories, operations, mining, that was less than 1% of the total population. Simply because the French didn't want the Vietnamese making stuff for profit. Just enough. Because the rest, we're going to give to them. Economic exploitation. Questions? Limited local consumption. But To say that these construction projects were grand, that's an understatement. Because hands down, one of the most significant projects that were undertaken by the French was a series of irrigation projects linked together that basically transformed the entire Mekong Delta. This entire region, hundreds of miles, was transformed within 40 years. Historically, this was nothing but a big, wet, swampy marsh. Because all of the great rivers in this peninsula fed down and entered the Indian Ocean through the Mekong Delta. The amount of walkable or usable or livable land was small. But the French sought to do something about it. So they started engaging in a series of infrastructure projects. Digging canals, building dikes and dams, and other type of drainage systems. From 1880 all the way to 1930, they would construct almost 1,200 miles of just canals. And some of the canals were used to drain the land. Others were used for transportation. That's a good example of one right there. You dig down below the water table, and essentially you allow the extra moisture someplace to go. In doing so, the amount of land they reclaimed is unthinkable. Rice production alone would increase by almost 500%. They literally increased farmable land. They went from about 500,000 hectares to 2.5 million hectares. They drained swamps and rivers and marsh, and it became dry land that could be farmed. And what can you do with more farmable land? Make more food. And there were some Vietnamese that got wicked, wicked, wicked rich. It's estimated that 2% of the landowners in Cochin China owned about 48% of the paddy fields. These guys would become super wealthy. And what did they do with their prosperity? They became landlords. They rented out their fields. They were tasked to be government agents. They became bankers and moneylenders. And because they were the ones who had money, whenever new acreage opened up, they quickly jumped in and they bought it. Because the new lands were not given to the people. No, the French sold it for profit. And if you had the most money, you can get the land. Now, the tragic truth is the majority population in South Vietnam, despite the fact that you now have this skyrocketing production, more land available, profit margins, you know, there were unthinkable levels. The truth be told is that 72% of the people who lived in the Mekong Delta, well, they got nothing. They possessed no land. They were illiterate. Couldn't read, couldn't write. They were just nothing more than peasants. These would be the laborers who would work on the lands of the wealthy. And even those who may have had some type of wealth before the French started doing these projects, they would lose everything. Now, one of the most telling stats that I found is that during this period, when they're draining the water, they're increasing the farmable land, they're increasing output by hundreds of percentiles, the individual peasant's consumption of rice would actually decrease. More food is available, but the people growing the food can't afford to buy it. Because 60 to 70% of what was grown was sold to the government, for the government to sell. Mostly not in Vietnam. And if that was not bad enough, the French would impose property taxes, sales taxes, excise taxes. Probably not as bad as we got. You know, in Massachusetts, between federal taxes, state taxes, and local taxes, you only keep about 40% of every dollar you earn. It's called Taxachusetts for a reason. We get screwed. Well, imagine if you had no money. How are you going to pay property taxes? Well, you have no money, you can't buy land, so you don't have to worry about the property taxes. But what happens when the government comes in and imposes an excise tax on, say, your cow, or your chickens, or your pigs? You got to pay those taxes. Or what happens if they impose sales taxes? So if you try buying a tool, suddenly you got to pay extra money. What happens if you had no money to pay the taxes? Well, the French had a solution. You paid your taxes by being forced to engage in labor. The peasants were the ones who engaged in these public works programs. And they didn't get any pay. They did it in lieu of having to pay taxes. They were also forced to work in mines. They had to work on rubber plantations. The working conditions were just unimaginable. Those who did get paid probably got paid pennies on the dollar. And there was no such thing as medical care. And I'm sure all the employment status was at will. Meaning whoever the manager was could fire you at a moment's notice. Well, the stories would reach the French government, because of course the French government kept inquiring about how things were going. Well, the truth was hidden. So when the reports were read in the French Parliament, everything was great. It was a new time of prosperity. Everyone was happy and joyous. It was beautiful. Well, unfortunately, the French government wouldn't realize how bad it was until the 1920s, when local rebel groups started engaging in terrorism. And that would ultimately open the eyes of the French, but by then it was too little too late. And even more tragic were those who were, lower middle class. Maybe some of the wealthy poor who could afford to own some lands, they didn't have it much better than the landless. ...62% of landowners only possessed 4% of the rice paddies. So you were lucky if you had like an acre. Not enough to feed your family. Plus, because the government controlled the markets, even if they did produce a little extra, they're going to get pennies on the dollar. Maybe 20% of the market share. And if you couldn't pay your taxes, well, the government took your land and foreclosed on it. And it would get gobbled up by the landowners. So by the 1910s, 1920s, there were some peasant families that had been living on the land that technically had been theirs going back generations. But they lost ownership of it. And it was owned by somebody else. And you couldn't get a loan because the wealthy landlords owned all the money. And there were no laws on interest rates. So, you know what you paid on your credit cards for interest? Most credit cards are like, what, 20, 22, 25%? So every dollar you pay, you're going to basically have to pay back $1.25. Well, imagine if your interest rate was 80%, 120%, 150%. Those are called usury laws. Well, there were none. So the land money lenders could basically charge you whatever interest rate you wanted. And they could foreclose on a moment's notice. So you try to work hard to get a loan so you can get a farm. And then you have a bad harvest, and before you know it, you lost the farm. Questions? Well, do you want to know why those acts of violence erupted in the 1920s? Well, here you go. Two reasons. One, there were no civil liberties whatsoever. None of the things that we take for granted of, speech, association, right to defend ourselves, keep and bear arms, right to own property, none of that existed. There also was no due process. There was no trial by jury. The government could come and arrest you, drag you away, take your home, take your possessions. You had no rights. Second, the Vietnamese had no say. The French would take over their country entirely. You know, it's one thing if you had local collaborators. That's one of the reasons why the British were able to control India for so long, so easily. Because the British always had local puppets who basically claimed they were doing things in the name of the people. So when the people got mad, you know, they would blame their local government. They wouldn't blame the British. But in Vietnam, no, it was just the French. And everybody knew it. So in time, the Vietnamese people were like, yeah, we're pretty all set. We're pretty done with that. Questions? Hopefully whatever video you're watching is going to give you the information that's on the test. Just saying. All right, if there's no questions, I'm done for the day. I got through what I wanted to do quicker than I intended. So, topics. I think I've approved two people's topics so far. If you haven't gotten me a topic yet, figure out something related to Vietnam. Vietnam War, us versus the Vietnamese, French versus the Vietnamese, something. And just let me know what it is. I got one on the Green Berets. I got one on the improvements of U.S. military aircraft technology. So there's lots out there. So just give it some thought and just let me know. Topics to do January 31st. Have a nice weekend.